I was working on my thesis problem, my research on quantum electrodynamics for a PhD in Princeton in the graduate school where I roomed. And Bob Wilson came in to say to me that he has a project. It's a secret. It's being supported by the government. They're going to do something. And it's a secret that he's not allowed to tell me what it is. But since he knows that after he tells me, I'll be sure to work on it, he feels there's no harm in telling me. So he told me about this business that they're going to try to make an atomic bomb. And in order to make that, they had to separate the uranium, the isotope that's light, from the isotope that's heavy in order to make it. And that he had an idea how to separate the isotopes, and that someone had decided that that idea was going to be pursued at Princeton, and he was recruiting people to do it. And then he wanted somebody to do the theoretical work on it to figure out which way we should go and whether it was possible first, in fact, the way he was designing it. And I told him that he'd made a mistake in telling me that I wasn't going to join the project because I had this thesis work I wanted to do, but that, never mind, the secret was okay with me anyway. And as he left, he said, all right, I'll see you at a meeting at 3 o'clock. This was in the early morning, I guess, in the morning, I suppose. So he went out. And I started to go back to desk and work a little bit, but of course I couldn't. I began to think about it. And I was worried about the possibility that the Germans would get this thing, this bomb thing. And that, to me, was a very serious fright. I didn't think that the German were would be very good if they had this kind of power, because they were already doing such horrible things to the people they had power over. So I figured I had better cooperate and help them with this. So at 3 o'clock I was at the meeting. And immediately after the meeting, you just decide who was going to do what and so forth. They gave me I was in the room where the experiment was being put, the first experiment was being put together. And I was in a roll top desk, and I had to calculate whether or not this thing would work or not. And so I worked as fast as I could, and from that moment on, I worked as fast as I could to figure this out. And it was like one of those moving pictures where you see them putting something together in a cartoon where everything gets bigger. But each time I would look up, the apparatus was getting bigger and more. They were putting it together. The reason is that they were borrowing equipment from their other experiments. The other guys had decided to stop working and had borrowed equipment from other experiments to put it all together to make this new experiment to test this idea out. Meantime, I was figuring this out, and finally I decided, yes, it would work. And I've heard it described the opposite way by one of the experimenters. Well, I describe how the experiment was being put together this way. They described this wild guy who was behind this roll-top desk, and pieces of paper would fly out going into the wastebasket in all directions, and finally he jumps out of his chair and says, it'll work, you see. So, and then continued in the project. That particular project, to set that particular method of Wilson's to separate the uranium, was not ultimately used. It was a different process, but we then went to Los Alamos.
I think what I'm trying to understand is that although, I mean, I suppose you were, what, maybe 22, 23 at that time, yes, whether or not you fully understood the sort of nature of the thing that you had to decide whether to get involved with or not.
Well as anybody understood it, yes. I don't mean I was smarter than anybody. I mean, it was common understanding about this. There was nothing problem about that. I mean, we might not know exactly how big a bomb you could make, or, you know, quantitative questions were involved, or in fact whether it was really possible to make it at all. There might be some problem about the cross-section for absorption of neutrons by uranium, which we had to determine later, that meant that the yield would be different than you'd think. We didn't know what the yield would be and so on, but it was clear to us. It just was a big thing. I mean, it was clear that it was Yes, it was very clear that it was a very, very powerful weapon, which in the hands of Hitler and his crew would be the complete control of the rest of the world.
Is it fair to ask you to explain a little more precisely what the nature of the sort of internal discussion you had with yourself was as to, I mean, your first intuition was not to get involved in it, was it?
Well, and yes. The reason I didn't want to get involved at that time was that I was working on my thesis, that I had gone pretty far with it, and I liked this problem of physics. This was a scientific question. I was wanted to be a scientist. The other question was not a scientific question. It was an engineering problem. The laws were partly known for this. If you had asked me to say we have to find out more about fission rates, I'd say, okay, but I'm working on this other physics problem. You do the experiment, fission rate, or whatever. But it wasn't that. It was a real development of a device that is like a technology, like an engineering. And it was a completely different kind of a thing. It would mean that I would have to stop the research in what I was doing, which is my life's desire to take time off to do this, which I felt I should do in order to protect civilization, if you want. Okay? So that was what I had to debate with myself. My first reaction, well, I didn't want to get interrupted in my normal work to do this odd job. There was also the problem, of course, of any moral thing involving war. I didn't want to have much to do with that, but it kind of scared me when I realized what the weapon would be, which I realized, and that since it might be possible, it was be possible. There was nothing that I knew that indicated that if we could do it, they couldn't do it, and therefore it was very important to try to cooperate. I had already tried to help with the war effort. I had spent the summer working for the Frankfurt Arsenal already, doing work of making a director, direct guns. But that was a small-time job compared to this one.
So how difficult a decision was it, really, you see, you make it sound as though it's a sort of, well, you know, that sounds okay, but, you know, I'm busy with something else. Whereas, of course, in retrospect, it sounds as though the decision ought to have been much more difficult than that, to get involved in something of which was potentially so dangerous.
Well, I don't know what you mean by difficult. It was difficult because, first of all, I decided one way, and then I had to turn myself around and worry about it and finally make a decision. I don't know how to measure difficulties of decision to tell you that it was difficulty 6 or difficulty 8. There were those considerations which I told you. I have a career, I have an aim in life, and I have to temporarily, or I don't know how long, stop doing that to do something else, okay? The motivation, and also at that time you have to appreciate there was a great deal of feeling of patriotism that people should cooperate in their country's problems.
I came across a letter of Oppenheimer's where he was writing to someone at Berkeley on your behalf from Los Alamos, and he was very effusive about you. I mean, I think it's summed up by him saying you're another Dirac, only human, and he lists all your qualities. And I just wondered if you could tell me a bit about Oppenheimer, what he was like. No.
No.
I mean, can you...
Yes, I'm not very good at describing people, and I knew him in the laboratory. He was the head of the laboratory, and he's a very personable man, and a very, he himself was extremely human, and made sure that all, see, I was in a lower level as a group leader or something, but we would have meetings in his office in which all the people who were concerned would discuss things together, and it was, everybody was allowed to say anything to anybody. It was very democratic. It wasn't the kind of hierarchy of where you had to know your place. Your point was everybody's place was to say anything they wanted to anybody else. A very remarkable organization that he made. And it's the problem of running a bunch of scientists in a new kind of circumstances had never been tried before. He somehow instinctively knew how to do it so that everybody was sort of happy. And we had, of course, we all had the same aim and we're working very hard toward it. But I thought he did a very first-rate job on that. When he recruited people to go to Los Alamos, for example, although he had all these complicated problems of what the story was going to be with secrecy and so on, and was arranging all these things in the big shots, even the little details he would worry about. For example, when he asked me to come, and I told him I had the problem that my wife at that time had tuberculosis, he himself found the hospital that was available and called me up to tell me that they had found a hospital to take care of my wife and so on. So, and I was just some one individual of all the people he was recruiting. But this is the way he always was, concerned with the individual problems of people. And also he was profounder. He could understand everything that we were doing, everybody was doing. He would try to figure out what we would say. We could discuss anything technically because he understood everything. And he would have, was good at summarizing things, for example, bringing together what everybody said and trying to come to a conclusion. So altogether, and as a human person, I mean, we met him, we would go to his house for dinner and so on. It was a wonderful man, I thought.
Isn't it a bit of a paradox that he was so human and could pay attention to all these human things, and yet was the man who must have been driven by the desire to see this terrible thing made?
No. I just went through a discussion as to what the various motives were for making this terrible thing. And in this situation in a wartime, your motives are very different. You're trying to destroy the enemy, and you're trying to protect your country. And this thing was a possibility which the men, the scientists, had to decide whether to do or not. And after that decision is made, they did it. I don't think I see a paradox.
Okay.
It's not inhuman to do the human thing of fighting other humans. That's a very human behavior, or maybe unfortunately. But which way we want to use the word human?
The next thing that happened was, of course, the test. After we'd made the calculations, we had to make the test. I was actually at home on a short vacation at that time, because my wife died. And so I got a message that said the baby was expected on such and such a day. So I flew back, and I just arrived on the site while the buses were leaving. I couldn't even get to my room. And I got out to the site, and we waited out there at the distance. We were 20 miles away. And we had a radio, and they were supposed to tell us when the thing was going to go off and so forth. And the radio wouldn't work, and we never knew what was happening. But just a few minutes before it was supposed to go off, the radio started to work, and they told us there was 20 seconds or something to go. The people that were far away, like we were, the others were closer, 6 miles away. And they gave out dark glasses that you could watch. I said, dark glasses? We're 20 miles away from the damn thing. We think it's dark glasses. I said, they're going to see a damn thing through dark glasses. And so what I figured, the only thing that will really hurt your eye, bright light never can hurt your eye, it's ultraviolet light that does. So I got behind a truck windshield so that the ultraviolet can't go through glass, so that would be safe. And so I could see the damn thing. Other people were never going to see the damn thing. Okay, time comes, and this tremendous flash out there, so bright, my head goes like this because it was so bright. And I see this purple splotch on the floor of the truck. And I says, that ain't it. That's an afterimage. So I turn back up and I see this white light changing into yellow and into orange. The clouds form and then they disappear again. The compression and the expansion forms and makes clouds disappear. And I saw, and then finally, a big ball of orange. It became a center that was so bright, became a ball of orange. It started to rise and billow a little bit and get a little bit black around the edges. And then you see it's a big ball of smoke with flashes on the inside of the fire going out, the heat. And I saw all that, and all this that I've just described in just a moment took about 1 minute. It was a series from bright to dark, and I had seen it. I'm about the only guy in the world who actually looked at the damn thing, the first Trinity test. Everybody else had dark glasses. The people at 6 miles couldn't see it because they were all told to lie on the floor with their eyes like this, so nobody saw it. And the guys up where I was all had dark glasses. I'm the only guy I saw with the human eye. Finally, after about a minute and a half, suddenly, there's a tremendous noise, bang, and then rumbles like thunder. And that's what convinced me. Nobody had said a word during this whole minute. We're all just watching quietly. But this sound released everybody. It released me particularly, because the solidity of the sound at that distance meant that it really worked. The man who was standing next to me said, when the sound went off, what's that? I said, that was the bomb.
Oppenheimer said later on, he said that these words from the Bhagavad Gita went through his mind, yes. You know, which is always rather impressive, you know, that I am become Death the Destroyer of Worlds. What went through your mind then when it went off?
My mind was rather dull. What went through my mind was a kind of elation, because during all this time we had been working very hard to make this thing go. And we weren't sure exactly how it went. And I realized that everything went quite along the way we calculated. I always had some distrust of theoretical calculations, although that's my business. And I'm never really sure that nature does what you calculate she ought to do, and she was doing what we calculated. There was also a general feeling that I had and shared with almost everybody else of a kind of glee of success, as when you do any kind of a job, you feel success. And so there was a considerable good feeling or happy feeling on the site of success. The only person that I remember who was directly aware of something different was Bob Wilson, the guy who got me into the project, who I remember standing in a hall and muttering something about this being terrible or something. And I, in my elation, couldn't understand him at all. I laughed at him and said, "What you got us into? I mean, you wanted us all to do this? You've been working out all the time? What's the feeling of..." I didn't understand it at the time. With regard to moral questions, I do have something I would like to say about it, because the original reason to start the project, which I had, which was that the Germans were in danger, started me off on a process of action, which was to try to develop this, first the system in Princeton, then at Los Alamos, to try to make the bomb work. All kinds of attempts to redesign, to make it a worse bomb, or whatever, and so on, and all working all this time to see if we can make it go. And so it was a project in which we all worked very, very hard and all cooperating together. And with any project like that, you continue to work trying to get success, having decided to do it. But what I did immorally, I would say, was not to remember the reason that I said I was doing it, so that when the reason changed, which was that Germany was defeated, not the single thought came to my mind at all about that, that that meant now that I have to reconsider why I'm continuing to do this. I simply didn't think, okay? And furthermore, when the thing was finally made, I was elated with success, the kind of elation you would get if you're trying to do something hard for 4 years and it works, what you were trying to do. So there is a type, I learned something from this, in that it is necessary, I think, one should reconsider perpetually one reason for doing something, because it may be that the circumstances have changed, which make you want to do that. I think the Vietnamese War, in the case of the United States, is another example of the same mistake in morality. Whatever the reasons were, good or bad, to start, they could be reconsidered as one goes along. This failure to reconsider the original purpose to do things, I would consider a moral weakness on my part during the war. When we were working, from the time we began, aside from my personal worry about it, I don't think that we didn't discuss it very much. But near the end of the war, there were discussions. First of all, after Germany was defeated, I believe it was, the question was whether we should use the bomb on Japan. The question was not discussed. Nobody thought about this at Los Alamos. It was discussed in Chicago. The reason may be that in the Chicago laboratory, they were finished with their job of making the devices and so on, where in Los Alamos we're still working very hard, so our minds were all on working, and we weren't thinking about what we were doing anymore. I think, we don't know human psychology, so that they could think about it and discuss it as to whether, what advice to give to the president, whether we should use it, whether we should make a demonstration or what. That was discussed in there, but not at Los Alamos. After the bomb was dropped in Japan, and the war was over, then there was a great deal of discussion of another problem, which is what kind of advice we should give the government, what the government should do with this thing, how we should react to other countries, and so forth. And there was a lot of discussion of this. At the same time, there was, of course, such discussion in the government itself. And various proclamations were made to advise the government as to which way to go and which way we felt it ought to go and so on. There were lots of very intense discussion on these questions at that time. Only reaction I remember, perhaps I was blinded by my own reaction, It was a very considerable elation and excitement. And there was kind of parties and people got drunk, and it would make a tremendously interesting contrast of what was going on in Los Alamos at the same time as what was going on in Hiroshima. I was involved with this happy thing, and also drinking and drunk and playing drums, sitting on the hood of the bonnet of a Jeep and playing drums and excitement running all over Los Alamos at the same time as the people were dying and struggling in Hiroshima. After I read about the kind of misery that the people were in and so on, I could find out what the destructive nature of the bomb was and what a serious problem it was for the future, for people to have such a bomb available, and how important it was for international control that this thing not become a weapon developed by different countries in opposition to each other as it is now developed. I had a very strong reaction after the war of a peculiar nature. It may be from just the bomb itself, and it may be for some other psychological reasons. I had just lost my wife or something. But I remember being in New York with my mother in a restaurant right after, immediately, and thinking about New York. And I knew how big the bomb in Hiroshima was, how big an area it covered and so on. And I realized from where we were, I know, 59th Street, to drop one at 34th Street, and then it would spread all the way out there, and all these people would be killed, and all the things would be killed. And that wasn't only one bomb available, but it was easy to continue to make them. And therefore, that things were sort of doomed, because already it appeared to me, very early, earlier than to others who were more optimistic, that international relations and the way people were behaving was no different than it had ever been before, and that it was just going to go out the same way as any other thing. And I was sure it was going to, therefore, to be used very soon. So I felt very uncomfortable and thought, really believed, that it was silly. I would see people building a bridge, and I would say, they don't understand. I really believed that it was senseless to make anything because it would all be destroyed very soon anyway, that they didn't understand that. And I had this very strange view of any construction that I would see. I would always thought how foolish they are to try to make something. So I was really in a kind of depressive condition.
How did you get out of that?
I don't know. I just grew out of it, I suppose. Or perhaps not sensibly. It just happened to be. It's a big surprise that things have lasted so long without it going off. I have not a very good understanding of international relations and human characteristics, and I thought that since everybody seemed to be behaving the same way as they did before, and since acting the way they did before, no matter what the weapon was, they were soon at each other's throats with it, that there was no reason to think that it would be any different this time. This was before we knew that the Russians were quickly developing one, but there was no doubt in my mind that they could develop one. What one fool can do, another can.
One of the famous things that Oppenheimer said sometime after this whole business was that I don't remember exactly how he phrased it, but this idea that physicists had somehow known sin, I mean, as mm-hmm. a result of building this bomb. And Freeman Dyson says in his book that what he thinks Oppenheimer meant was not that you'd built the bomb, but that you'd enjoyed building it so much, that maybe that was what he meant. Well, what do you think Oppenheimer meant by that? That
I don't know. What he meant was, of course, that we had made something which had impressive moral consequences, and had to think about that, I suppose. One doesn't always know what Oppenheimer meant with his most profound statements.
Let me ask you, I mean, now, all right, it's a long yes. time, and there hasn't been the use of nuclear yes. weapons and so on. I mean, do you think that that'll continue forever, or do you think that actually these things will get used sooner or later?
As you can tell from my past experience, I mispredicted in the past, okay? I thought it would be used before. Therefore, I've taught myself that I do not know how to predict the future on matters like this. I still think, in spite of the fact that I learned that I was wrong in predicting before, I still have this idea that it'll be used eventually. I don't see how humans will avoid it with the present way they behave. But since I don't understand humans that well, I really don't know what will happen.
is it fair to ask you whether you feel, you know, any sense of personal responsibility for this, I mean, actually incredible predicament that we're in?
For me, the correct question is what one should do, not how one should feel. The feeling may be important to develop in order to convert it to some sort of action. In other words, you say, because I feel this way, I ought to do so-and-so. But really, we should try to figure out what to do under the circumstances. I haven't been able to figure out what to do under the circumstances as given now. And I don't torture myself with some sort of remorse, because each time when I did these things, the way to hell is paved with good intentions, and you ask a man who's done a lot of good intentions and who's found himself in hell how he feels about his moral responsibility. Well, in each stage, he thought that he was doing the right thing. It's ignorance and lack of understanding, or whatever, which leads humans into their miseries, all right? And that's a profound thing, very general and very common in human behavior, that I'm not in any position to deeply understand any better than anybody else. So I don't know how to answer this question of moral responsibility, whether I did right or wrong under the circumstances. The only wrong that I really know is that I didn't think about it again, as I've already mentioned, when the Germans were defeated. What I don't guarantee you as to what conclusion I would have come to if I thought about it again at that point. But nevertheless, the fact that I did not think about it is, of course, wrong. But I don't know if I can identify any other wrong.
And of course, most of you were very young, weren't you?
Yes.
Well,
I was.
Yeah.
Well, I was 24 when I entered the project, and about 28 when I left.